Chapter 1. If a young lady did not wish to be murdered, it was advisable that she not spend her evenings meeting with strangers on dark street corners. Mallory knew this. She was an expert on not getting murdered, a skill she tended to value higher than, say, embroidering pincushions or playing scales on a harpsichord or the proper way of holding a salad fork. Mallory knew how to hold a salad fork, thank you very much, and it was in a tight fist while you sent those sharp little tines straight into the thigh of a would-be attacker. Or the eyeball. Or the gullet. The human body had plenty of vulnerable places to choose from, and she didn't like to limit herself. Mallory waited, adjusting her grip on her artist portfolio. She heard the distant whinny of a horse, the grind of carriage wheels a block over, a colony of bats squeaking overhead. Though the shadows reached for her, she remained haloed in the light of the street's single oil lamp, so she would be easy for her clients to spot. "Easy to murder," a voice whispered, and in response she idly scratched her leg with the toe of her boot, feeling the handle of the dagger she kept hidden there. It might have been more respectable to keep it hidden beneath her skirts, but if she was under attack, she hardly wanted to waste time digging through layers of muslin and wool. What was she going to do? Ask her attacker to kindly pause while she searched for the weapon in her garter? Boot heels clipped on the cobblestones as two gentlemen meandered past. She stood straighter, expecting her clients. One man was dressed entirely in black, while the other wore every color under the sun. She eyed them warily, but they merely tipped non-existent hats to her as they vanished into the night. The clock tower in the city square chimed the 11th hour. Her foot tapped impatiently. Finally, from the moon-spotted shadows, two new figures emerged on the other side of the street. Mallory studied them as they entered the lamplight. The man was light-skinned, broad and portly, wearing a stylish capotin hat and ruffled cravat. Either high society or pretending to be, in hopes he would eventually get admitted into their exclusive circles. His companion was a petite girl in a shapeless crimson robe, the trailing hem gathering filth from the street. Her hair had been shaved nearly to the scalp, making way for the delicate tattoo of a bow and arrow above her left ear. Mallory's eyebrows lifted in surprise. She'd had many odd characters on her tours. The scholars who peppered her with earnest questions about the mansion's history, and the Saphir's family's current political affiliations. Luckily, Mallory was adept at making things up, because really, how should she know? There were those who were intrigued by anything to do with the occult, not because it was strange or taboo, but because it was fascinating. The guests who came for a thrill so they could proclaim drunkenly to their friends back at the tavern that they had survived the House Saphir. And then there were the romantics, the ladies who were determined to swoon, and the suitors who were determined to protect them with needless acts of chivalry. But a priestess of Tyr? This was a new one. "Welcome, priestess," said Mallory. "You're a long way from the nearest temple." The girl giggled shyly.
"I am only an initiate. I take the vows next week."
"My sister has decided to devote her life and service to the gods," the man said dryly. "I cannot fathom why."
The girl kept smiling, though there was an edge to her expression.
"That's because you can't fathom devoting your life to anyone but yourself."
The man shrugged. Mallory hated to admit it, but a part of her agreed with him. Devotion to the seven gods had become a popular pastime among society's elite after the fall of the veil nearly two decades ago. But she didn't see the appeal. As far as she could tell, The gods were taking no more interest in the affairs of humans now than they had back when the veil was still in place.
"This is where the tour begins, is it not?"
asked the man.
"The House Saphir tour," she said.
"The one full of torture and dismemberment? Yes, you're in the right place. Though usually this tour appeals to heathens and outcasts, whereas you both appear so very respectable." The man's cheek twitched, evidently unsure if she was complimenting or insulting them.
"You must be Sophia and Louis Dumas," said Mallory, shifting her weighty portfolio to her other hand. "What brings you here tonight?"
"I feel it is my duty to introduce my sister to something of the world before they lock her up in that temple and never let her out again," said Louis.
"Priestesses are not prisoners, Louis. And there will be plenty of travel. One of my foremost responsibilities will be visiting townships to preside over treaties and peaceful negotiations, attending ceremonial hunts, blessing the weaponry of our great—"
"Yes, yes, what an exciting life you will lead,"
Louis interrupted while shooting Mallory a "see what I mean" look.
"This is our last night in Morant. We had our fortunes told by a quaint little witch on Rue Tillance, and she suggested we take this tour before we depart. She spoke highly of the guide."
Mallory smiled thinly. That quaint little witch was her older sister.
"I'll try not to disappoint." "She had the most fascinating wares in her shop," Sophia said, studying the iron gate that towered above the street. "Louis bought an authentic god relic, one of Verdith's golden feathers. We were guaranteed it would bring him good luck in the coming year."
"A rare treasure indeed," said Mallory, pretending to be impressed.
"What did you pay for it?"
Louis puffed up his chest.
"Only 12 lis."
"A bargain." Mallory turned her head so he wouldn't see her proud grin. That was well worth the cost of the gold foil and hours that Anaïs had spent figuring out how to apply it to those damned crow feathers. She glanced up as the moon winked from behind a cloud. Her final guest, a Monsieur Badeau, was officially late.
"We are waiting for one more gentleman to join us. Then we shall begin."
"You mentioned heathens," said Monsieur Dumas in a joking tone. "I imagine this tour draws plenty of unsavory characters."
"On occasion," said Mallory. "But then, you are taking the tour, are you not?"
Louis frowned.
"What are you implying?"
"Only that it's rare to truly know a person's character, whether they are complete strangers or our dearest relations. Most people, if asked to imagine the circumstance of their own murder, will picture a stranger, perhaps a random attack in some dark alley. But study enough murders and you'll come to realize that it's far more common for the victim and the killer to know one another, sometimes intimately. It's usually the husband, but—" She heaved a dramatic sigh. "Murder between siblings is not unheard of." Sophia's brow pinched in mild confusion, like she couldn't imagine why Mallory was telling her this, even as her brother sputtered in offense. Before he could defend his honor and proclaim that he did not have any intention of killing anyone, though,
isn't that what they all say?
Mallory held out a palm. "While we wait, the cost of the tour is 6 galleys each, paid up front."
6 galleys," said Louis. "That fortune teller told us—"
Sophia nudged him hard in the ribs, cutting him off. With a grumble, he dug the payment from his coin purse.
"Fabulous," said Mallory, tucking the money away. "As our final companion is running late, perhaps we will begin without him."
She faced the mansion, which sat like a crouched monster in the shadows off the street corner, illuminated by the faintest hint of lamplight and a touch of silver from the waxing moon. The chains on the gate were an illusion. They were bulky and ominous, crafted of iron and rust, and were generally enough to deter curious passers-by from trespassing on the abandoned grounds. But if anyone bothered to look closely, they would see that the padlock on the chains was broken and had been for some time. Mallory had absolutely nothing to do with that. She swore.
Is it legal for us to be here? Asked Sophia as Mallory unwound the clinking chain.
Not to worry, I conduct these tours all the time, Mallory said, pretending that was a proper answer. Sophia did not press further. The hinges screamed as Mallory pushed the gate open and squeezed through. Louis made a face as the lichen-covered metal left streaks on his jacket, though Sophia did not seem to mind the same smudges on her robes. A straight pathway led through the garden to the mansion, but Mallory walked slowly, allowing the tourists to take in the dried-up fountains, the crumbling garden walls, and, before them, the mansion. Narrow but tall, with three floors for living and entertaining, plus an attic that was mostly servants' quarters. The exterior was entirely white limestone, but soot, dirt, and trailing vines of ivy and wisteria had been doing their best to devour the facade for decades. Leaded and stained glass windows that had been the height of fashion a century ago were now filthy, broken, or both. The massive entry doors, an arch of dark oak, were carved with medallions of demonic boar heads. A fitting welcome, Mallory thought, to the house that claimed such a sordid past. Let us begin, said Mallory, walking backward on the cobblestone path. What do you know about Monsieur Le Bleu? After a hesitation, Louis responded,
He murdered people.
Wives, Sophia added, her voice quietly reverent. He murdered his wives.
Mallory tucked her portfolio beneath one arm and began her recitation.
His name was Count Bastien Saphir, but most people know him by his moniker, Monsieur Le Bleu. Thus named because his hair and beard were so black that in certain lights, they were said to appear almost blue. Of course, the surname Saphir may have had something to do with it as well.
She paused between two weed-infested garden beds. It was difficult to picture them as they had once been, with manicured boxwoods and colorful geraniums.
He was born in his family's country estate outside the village of Camors, 40 miles northwest of here, and grew up an only child, the sole heir of the family winemaking fortune. For generations, Saphir's estate, Ruby Camors, was one of the most expensive and sought-after wines on the market. As it is fortified with brandy, it can be preserved for years, even decades, and many say the flavor improves with time. This has made it particularly desirable with merchants who trade with countries as far as Isbrin and Gaiyin, where it is a rare commodity among the nobility. Connoisseurs also appreciate that the additional alcohol gets you drunk faster. She climbed the front steps to the house. But Bastien was bored with country life, so when he was 21 years of age, he bought this parcel of land here in the heart of Morant for the construction of the mansion before you. He spared no expense, as you can see from the gold-plated sundial on the south terrace and the decorative medallions that ornament the upper floors, each one unique and hand-carved by a local artisan. I beg your pardon, interrupted Monsieur Dumas,
whose scowl had been deepening as Mallory had set the stage for her horrific tale.
Are you going to give the entire tour?
Mallory stared at him,
That was my intention. But you're...
His puzzled expression turned to one of distaste.
I thought you were the secretary, or, you know, the one who would greet us and take our hats and coats, not the guide.
Mallory's jaw twitched.
You were mistaken.
But this tour is about... murder.
He dropped his voice.
It isn't ladylike to speak of such things.
Sophia grimaced in embarrassment. Mallory was beginning to understand why Sophia might want to run off and join an order that pledged their lives to the god of archery and war, a god who did not care if you were male or female or something else altogether. If Louis was going to make comments like this all night, she would spend her evening fighting the urge to roll her eyes. That was a lie. She would roll her eyes without hesitation and without apology. But it might cost her a tip at the end of the night, and no amount of chauvinism would change the weight of his coins in her purse. She sighed.
I am Moran's foremost expert on Monsieur Leblanc and the Saphir family, and currently the only tour guide operating at this mansion.
If your delicate sensibilities would prefer to spend the evening in the gambling hall, I will not keep you. But if you wish to see inside the house, then I suggest you decide quickly so we can move on. She paused before adding, also the fee is non-refundable. Monsieur Dumas cast a disapproving look at his sister, as though he didn't want her getting ideas from such a headstrong woman, which made Mallory wonder how much he knew about the patron god his sister had chosen to serve.
As I was saying, once the house was complete, Monsieur Leblanc began to spend nearly all his time here in Morant, which is where our tale truly begins.
Taking hold of the handle shaped like a sea serpent, Mallory pulled the door open with a dramatic, creaking groan.
Welcome to the House Saphir.
Chapter 2. Shadows reached for them as they stepped through the doorway. The foyer was thick with the smell of dust and mildew and rat droppings. Mallory was used to it, but Sophia wrinkled her nose and Louis pulled out a handkerchief to cover his mouth. Mallory picked up the lantern she kept on the vestibule table and lit the candle inside, illuminating the foyer. An ornate, geometric pattern in white and blue tiles spanned from the doorway into the drawing room. A mahogany staircase curved upward, each balustrade carved into an ominous hooded figure. An arched doorway straight ahead guided visitors into the corridor to the dining hall and ballroom. It was a dizzying way to be received, which was quite by design. This was not a house intended to make visitors feel comfortable. It was intended to make them feel awed, honored, and entirely unbalanced. Mallory lit the occasional candle as they passed through the ground floor of the mansion, explaining the purpose of various rooms as she went. The parlor where guests had once been greeted with a glass of House Saphir's famous wine, served ice cold in the summer months, the epitome of luxury. The solarium, where some broken pots still remained, the last vestiges of what must have been a lush jungle encased in glass. Mallory explained how Bastien Saphir had loved oranges and thus insisted on keeping a live orange tree in the center of the room so he would always have the fruit at hand. She pointed out the empty bird cages that still hung from the ceiling. Having once displayed golden canaries and melodic nightingales for the enjoyment of Saphir's guests. They passed through the dining room with its paneled walls and ornate chandeliers that now boasted as many cobwebs as crystals, while Mallory spoke of the lavish parties, the fine soirees, the endless feasts that Saphir had hosted for Morant's elite. With a reputation for generosity, he was said to be the most upstanding of gentlemen. Invitations to his home were highly coveted. Mallory approached a wall where a painting was concealed behind a swath of black velvet. He was also devilishly handsome. She pulled back the velvet. The glow from her lantern danced across a portrait of a gentleman wearing a richly embroidered blue and gold cape over a matching doublet. The portrait had been commissioned when Bastien Saphir was in his mid-20s, and his features were startling in their severity. As if a sculptor had taken a chisel to his jutting cheekbones and sharp jaw. A tidy beard and mustache were as black as ink, as was the long, dark hair tied at the nape of his neck. Most striking were his eyes. Even in the dim lighting, they were alarmingly blue, a distinctive family trait. An unladylike sound filled the room, the noise of someone sticking out their tongue and blowing out air. Mallory had been expecting it, and she tried not to cringe. "If he's devilishly handsome," said a high-pitched nasal voice, "then I'm the queen of Lysro." Mallory didn't answer. It would have made her guests uncomfortable, given that they hadn't heard a thing. Rule number one when it came to interacting with ghosts: never, ever engage with them when a living person was nearby. Do not look. Do not react. Most people already thought she and her sister were peculiar. No point making it worse. Instead, she surreptitiously scanned the room. Trifine was sitting at the head of the dining table, her feet propped up beside a candelabra, her slight figure dressed in a nightgown and pale blue shawl, the edges of her physical form shimmering slightly. All ghosts shimmered, their bodies trapped somewhere between corporeal and ephemeral. Trifine had been beautiful in life, and was just as beautiful in death, with the delicate bone structure of a duchess descended from Gai Yin royalty. Her luster was only slightly marred by the blackish red blood that covered the front of her chest, compliments of the sword that had impaled her.
"I always pictured him as a pirate," Sophia said quietly, still staring at the painting, unaware of the ghost's presence. Her voice had a dreamlike quality to it as she took in Le Bleu's secretive grin. "I thought he would be rougher looking, less genteel."
"A pirate," said Trifine haughtily. "Where do you find these people?"
"It's a common misconception," said Mallory. "The Saphir family owned many merchant ships for exporting their wine, and so had a lucrative trade business on the side. Though Monsieur Le Bleu did occasionally travel by ship for work, he was no pirate. Come, I will show you the ballroom."
"Oh, you're going to ignore me again, are you?" said Trifine, standing to follow as Mallory led the couple through a set of double doors. "That's exceedingly impolite, Miss Fontaine. You know I was struggling with a horrid cough last week. Could feel the sickness all through my chest. Was bedridden for days. And you're not even going to ask how I'm feeling." She let out a stream of wet coughs to punctuate her irritation.
Mallory walked faster, hoping the clack of her boots on the ballroom's parquet floors would drown out the ruckus of Trifine's complaints. She busied herself lighting a few of the wall sconces while Sophia and Louis took in the space. There was a raised platform where musicians would have played, and heavy curtains to hide stage performers, tall arched windows and walls lined with glittering mirrors. It would have been glorious in its day, but now the reflections were eerie and faint in the flickering candlelight, the still air dank and suffocating. Trifine clutched her shawl against an imaginary chill. She alone did not cast a reflection. you know, I had something important to tell you, Mallory. But if you're going to ignore me, then I won't say a word, and you're going to wish I had.
Mallory doubted that. Trephine had her uses, but she was also a constant thorn in Mallory's side.
What happened there?
Said Louis, pointing to a corner of the room where black scorch marks marred the floors and walls. Some of the gilded wallpaper was missing, revealing blackened wood beneath. Some children sneaked in years ago, said Mallory. Thought it would be amusing to light a few candles and try to summon the spirit of Le Bleu back from the dead. Instead, they nearly burned the place to the ground. Luckily, a few neighbors saw the smoke and managed to put out the flames in time. A thump came from overhead. Everyone stilled, nervous gazes rising to the ceiling with its tin panels and chandeliers that had not seen candles in decades. Mallory cleared her throat. Well, it is haunted, she said with a light laugh.
Mallory, said Trephine, that wasn't me. Monsieur Le Bleu's first marriage was to Duchess Trephine Mang, Mallory interrupted, ignoring Trephine's affronted harumph. Their wedding ceremony took place right here in this room. Nearly 300 guests were in attendance. But she was not only his first wife. Mallory paused dramatically. She was also his first victim. Sophia shivered. Her brother, checking his teeth in one of the mirrors, did not.
Fine, ignore me, Trephine said. But if you're going to talk about me like I'm not even here, then you'd better at least tell them about my flowers.
Le Bleu was the most eligible bachelor in Morant. The wedding was quite a spectacle. Mallory opened up her drawing portfolio, revealing the first page, a charcoal sketch of the ballroom they now stood in, bedecked with elaborate flower arrangements on every wall. The decor for the event was well documented. The florist hired to decorate the house earned undeniable fame for the extravagant arrangements made of tropical fruits and fragrant flowers, the kinds of which most of the guests had never seen before. They were brought to Morant under special glass domes to retain the heat and moisture from their natural habitats.
They were beautiful, Trephine crowed. The wedding of the century, they called it.
Did we pay to hear you talk about flowers? Grunted Louis. Get on with it.
Sophia smacked him on the arm.
14 months after the wedding, Mallory continued, Trephine gave birth to Bastien II. He was the only child Le Bleu would sire. Almost immediately following the birth, rumors began to circulate that Trephine had fallen ill, that childbirth had been too much for her. She was overcome with fatigue, eating poorly, spending weeks at a time in bed, too frail to venture into society.
My mother always said I had a weak constitution, said Trephine, but I was actually feeling quite invigorated after a few days of bed rest. Still, Bastien wouldn't let me leave, kept saying I needed more rest to be strong to raise our child. She snorted. Manipulative bastard.
Less than 3 months after the birth of their son, Duchess Trephine Mang Saphir was dead. No doctor had been called to see to her ailments. No coroner came to view the body. The sacred rites of Velos were not to be followed. No anointments or prayers, no adorning her with flowers, no preparation for a proper burial. Sophia gasped, apparently more appalled at the lack of ritual than she was at the thought of murder.
Bastien claimed to have conducted the rituals and buried the body himself, said Mallory.
He claimed it was out of fear that Trephine's disease was contagious, and he did not want to risk the lives of his servants or the townspeople. As he was so very good at playing the part of the mourning widower, no one thought to question him.
Lying
scumbag, Trophine muttered.
Mallory let her voice drip with irony. If ghosts could talk, perhaps Duchess Trophine could tell us the truth of what happened to her. But as it is, we are left to our own speculations.
Oh, har har, very funny.
Mallory gestured to the ballroom's wide expanse. Rumor has it that Trophine still haunts these rooms. To this day, you might catch a glimpse of her wandering the halls in her pale nightgown and blue shawl. They say that at times her spirit will reach out to those who come to visit. Mallory stretched out her hand, as if she would tap Monsieur Dumas on the shoulder, though he was halfway across the room. And that she asks for one thing, the same question. Over and over again. A shriek pierced the heavy air. Sophia, deathly pale, pointed at something behind Mallory. A shadow fell across the floor. She saw him, a figure reflected in the mirror. A man tall and slender with black hair and a long jacket, looming from the darkness not two steps behind her. Fingers grazed the sleeve of Mallory's dress. Her mind lurched. Intruder. Murderer. Leblanc. On instinct, Mallory reached behind her and caught hold of the hand. She twisted his arm, throwing her weight into the movement as she drove the figure to the ground. The floors shook as he landed with a grunt, the air knocked clean out of him. Mallory stared down at a boy. Maybe an intruder, maybe a murderer, but not a particularly threatening one, and certainly not the ghost of Monsieur Leblanc. He pressed a hand to his chest as he attempted to draw in breath. Who in Velos's name are you? Mallory cried. He wheezed slightly, then managed to suck in enough air to mutter, Axel Vadeau, he coughed. I'm here for the tour.